Hello, and welcome to the podcast of MoralApologetics.com. We're glad you're here. I'm your host, Jonathan Pruitt. And as always at MoralApologetics.com, our aim is to get you thinking about the moral argument because it has the ability to both illuminate the mind and stir the heart. This week's episode, we'll be talking again with Dr. David Baggett, co-author of Good God, along with Dr. Jerry Walls. Good God, of course, was a Christianity Today's 2012 Book of the Year in Apologetics. And Dr. Baggett and Dr. Jerry Walls have just recently finished writing the sequel to Good God. And today on the show, we're going to be talking with Dr. Baggett about one of the chapters in the book, the chapter on the problem of evil. So we're going to get an overview of the chapter here before the book's even released, which is pretty exciting. So with that in mind, we'll go ahead and get right to it. We'll go over to Dr. Baggett's office here in Lynchburg, Virginia, and hear what he has to say about the problem of evil. I want to ask you, Dr. Baggett, so let's start off with this. What is the problem of evil? Why is it a problem for the Christian theism?
The problem of evil is defined as the challenge of reconciling God's existence, with the evil that we find in the world, right? And especially on a certain theology, according to which God is perfectly good, perfectly powerful, perfectly knowledgeable, and so forth. Why is it that there would be evil in the world, especially in the distribution as we find it, and in the intensity that we find it? Intuitively, it's not the sort of world that you'd expect. If God exists and is a perfectly good, all-powerful God, a world in which there's so much suffering as we find in this world, there's something counterintuitive about that idea. And so the problem of evil, construed as an argument or challenge against God's existence, is the idea that it seems unlikely, if not flat impossible, that we'd find a world in which there's so much suffering, if indeed God exists in anything like the sense of classical theism. More broadly, of course, you could say the problem of evil is a problem that we all face as human beings. Why is it that there is evil at all? This whole category of evil and so much suffering and so forth. It's not just a theoretical challenge. It's a practical challenge in all of our lives. Both natural evils and moral evils, they stymie us, they flummox us, they frustrate us. We don't know what to say sometimes, oftentimes, in the face of various evils and sufferings and trials in this world. Whatever one's worldview, evil constitutes, in that sense, a challenge for us. So if you don't use it in that technical sense, the problem of evil is reconciling evil with God's mm-hmm. existence, you can talk about the problem of evil more generally as a problem for human beings of all types, of all types of worldviews. What do we say, and what, perhaps more importantly, do we do, in the face of suffering that we encounter in this world?
So for the naturalist, though, is there any tension with their worldview in saying that, humans face evils every day, maybe even, particularly just horrible evils? Is there tension there, you think, or is that just for the theist that has to deal with this?
I think in that broader sense, the problem of evil is a problem for us all, right, irrespective of our worldview, right? So even if I were an atheist, I'd still have to struggle with suffering, okay. Have to struggle with evil, including, some real meaning-depriving evils, right? Sicknesses that can just deprive people of the will to live, or can result in the loss of limbs or cognitive faculties or whatever, or the loss of loved ones. It's a world full of suffering, and if there's not a story according to which there's some kind of ultimate hope in the face of it, the sufferings can appear to be all the more meaningless. And so, in that sense, the problem of evil in that broader understanding, I think can be a very deep source of trouble, for our atheist friends to struggle with in a practical sort of way. And then, we typically distinguish between two sorts of evils, right? Moral evils and natural evils. Mm-hmm. And the word evil itself, has come to be thought of by some as probably more properly applicable to the moral evils, right? So, like, if you were to do something really, heinous and horrible to me, I'd be like, oh man, Jonathan, that was just evil.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. Whereas, if I get hit by lightning or something, that kind of a naturalistic, event, is it really evil or is it just, just bad luck, right? Or even if an earthquake happens and I happen to be living in the wrong place, is it evil, right? Or is it just a natural sort of event? I think that some have developed a bit of a hesitation in using that word evil in the stronger sense,
Mm-hmm.
And they just want to talk about suffering maybe in general, in which case, whether it's inflicted by moral evil or natural evil, suffering, regardless, suffering either way. But in terms of a robust category of moral evil, that might, I suppose, produce a certain tension in some of our naturalist friends who gravitate toward determinism, because if they think that everything that happens is caused to happen inevitably and inexorably, just as it happens, and couldn't have been otherwise, does it really make sense to speak in terms of, that was a moral evil that you inflicted upon me that you should not have, right? Because what does it mean to say you shouldn't have if you were determined to do just what you did, right? So this has, I think, detracted from some people's confidence in affirming the category of robust moral evils in the face of the challenge of something like determinism. And then there are others who continue to use that language. But of course, sometimes this is a little disingenuous, because on the one hand, you'll have someone like Richard Dawkins who'll say things that kind of debunk morality, mm-hmm. like the world is exactly as it, inevitably is supposed to be. I mean, there's no departure from it. But on the other hand, faced with certain moral evils, especially, perpetrated by religious people or something like mm-hmm. that, he wants to start talking about, moral categories of all of a sudden, wow, this is so horrible. This is so evil. Or the God of the Old Testament. I mean, he uses very loaded moral language for right. this. But if the whole category of morality is kind of debunked, how consistent is that? So there's that issue, but that's kind of an easy criticism. I think that there are plenty of sincere atheists who still want to retain the category of evils, be they moral or natural, and who honestly just wish to struggle with them and know what best to say in response to them, and again, more importantly, perhaps, what to do in the face of them. So I don't see this, first and foremost as an apologetic tool, in our arsenal, like, ooh, let's use evil to, make our case. This is a profound human struggle that all of us, believers and unbelievers alike, have. And I think it's well worth, struggling with, discussing, and trying to get our minds around.
Okay. Well, I think that doesn't Plantica, in his 24 or so theistic arguments, mention a argument from evil, though? I mean, I don't remember. Do you know how that
yeah.
goes?
Yeah, he does. He kind of wants to turn the tables on our atheist friends by saying, traditionally the problem of evil has been used against the theists.
Right.
But in point of fact, I mean, there really is a challenge that you can pose against our atheist friends from this whole direction of the problem of evil. And it has to do with, well, what really would make anything genuinely evil, right? Say in a determined world, in a purely naturalistic world. If an ant gets stepped on in the forest, by a larger animal or something, mm-hmm. Was that evil? It was just something that happened in the natural world, right? But in a similar sort of way, whatever strong feelings we might attach to a human being dying from a disease or being killed by another human being, isn't this just the inexorable process of the physical world operating according to causal laws on that sort of picture of the world, right? On a naturalistic picture of the world. Can you really retain this category of some things are genuinely evil? It seems to be a robust moral category that's considerably harder to account for and explain with a set of naturalistic assumptions than with a set of theistic ones. So, he tries to turn the tables there on our naturalistic friends by really sort of calling into question the terms of the discussion. And I think what he's implicitly doing is pointing out the way in which, how the problem of evil often gets discussed, is parasitic on categories that depend for their legitimacy on a theistic worldview. So, that's an interesting phenomenon if he's right, and I suspect he may well be.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think that in the book God and Cosmos, you and Dr. Walls make maybe a similar response to the problem of evil as that. And you know, the literature on this topic is just tremendous. There are theists and atheists have been working on this problem for a long time, and there's a lot to say about it. But you had sort of maybe a little bit of a unique approach in that you didn't necessarily try to solve the problem, but you said it's important to keep the problem as a problem. Maybe you could explain a little bit about what you mean by that.
Well, yeah. To begin with, the problem of evil is really a problem. I mean, it's very challenging. It's very difficult. And I don't mean to suggest that it's an intractable intellectual obstacle for theists. I suspect it's not in that sense. But that doesn't mean that it's not just a huge challenge, a huge existential struggle and an ongoing problem. I mean, even if you can make the case ultimately, say, for the reconcilability of a perfectly good, loving God with the evil that we find in this world, that still leaves you rather speechless in front of the mother who just lost her child from cancer or something like that, right? And if you start lecturing about, you know, the philosophical answer for the reconcilability of suffering, right, with God's existence, I think that your words would be cold comfort indeed. I think Plantinga himself, in fact, uses that phrase to characterize his own, you know, analysis of the issue. It's cold comfort. It doesn't penetrate nearly deeply enough. By the way, I think this is why Marilyn Adams's little book, despite what I consider to be some of its flaws, is such a powerful book. What is it? I forget the name of it.
Horrendous Evils and the Good God or something like
Goodness
that.
Goodness of God. Horrendous Evils and the Goodness of God. I think that's right. Yeah. Where she really comes to terms with the fact that, you know, no, this is a really big ongoing challenge and struggle. And N.T. Wright, similarly, in his book on the problem of evil, I think makes some very good points about how, it's not our job as Christians and theists simply to try to solve the problem of evil, right? Ultimately, we think that there is a solution and a resolution to these things. But even if the world were to turn into a utopia tomorrow, which it's not, but even if it were, that doesn't undo the horrific sufferings in the past or the grave injustices of the past and whatnot. And some people can experience the worst sort of sufferings that just defy our imagination, you know, practically to get our minds around, you know. A woman raped and then her limbs hacked off, a child dying from leukemia at the age of four, a father, you know, backing his car out of the driveway and unwittingly running over his child and having to live with that the rest of his life. These are big problems. These are horrific challenges. And I can wholly understand why people struggle with the problem of evil. And I think that they should. I think it's inhuman for us not to. You know, Nietzsche I think, had this idea that, you know, it shouldn't be a struggle at all because the world is as it is. And that's just the way it goes. But to me, this is just another way in which Nietzsche just rejected his, humanity, or lost an aspect of his humanity. As normal, healthy, properly functioning persons, we should struggle with the evils that we find in this world. So that's actually part and parcel of at least part of what we're saying here in the new book, God and Cosmos. We're not offering a new solution or anything like that. We think that God is at work in this world, redeeming suffering, and ultimately he holds out the hope that there is an ultimate resolution. We agree with Marilyn Adams that God is, the good, the ultimate good, and in such a way that relationship with him constitutes an incommensurable good, potentially for each and every one of us, big enough to redeem and indeed to defeat any evils, however horrific, that we might endure in this world. But we don't dwell on those things primarily. The main thing that we kind of want to say is this, and it might come across as paradoxical or something at first, but we think it's really important that the problem of evil needs to be a problem. It really needs to be a problem in a world such as this one. And if your worldview can't really see it as a problem, can't mm-hmm. really articulate why it's a problem, can't really retain the categories needed to explicate it as a problem and understand it deeply as one, then so much the worse for your worldview. Now take moral evils, right? The moral evils that people do to each other, right? It seems to me this is a perfect example. In order for us truly to characterize horrendous behaviors of persons against persons as evils that should not have happened, that should have been otherwise, that should have been avoided, that are culpable, that are proper occasions for deep ascriptions of moral responsibility, then it seems to me that people need meaningful agency, mm-hmm. right? If I am just causally determined to do all that I do, right, then how deeply responsible am I for the actions that I perform? And as we talk about in chapter 4 of the new book, right, even many naturalists are coming to terms with the fact that with the resources at their disposal, with their worldview, they're going to have an awfully hard time accounting for something like moral responsibility. Even if they make sense of the category of freedom, or even moral freedom, mm-hmm. in some kind of, say, compatibilist sense, right?
Right.
Like, I can't do otherwise. We're all determined to do what we do, you know. But we're still free in the sense that we, at least on occasion, do what we want to do and that sort of thing. And we can do otherwise, at least in the counterfactual sense, that had we wanted to do otherwise, then we would have been able to do otherwise. So this is a sort of a compatibilist understanding of free will. On that sort of view, even if you embrace the idea of free will, it doesn't mean that you've carved out space for deep moral responsibility, right? And so, we discuss a recent book, was it by Waller? I think who makes this case. He says, look, as a naturalist, I can make sense of free will and even moral freedom, but I can't make sense of ascriptions of traditional moral responsibility,
right?
And then someone like Dennett argues against him, but we really argue that Waller has the better arguments here, and that Dennett's the less consistent on this particular issue. But here's the thing: if you lose the category of deep moral responsibility, how can you retain the category of deep moral evils? You see, so we see this as a problem, because something like the problem of evil, in that broader sense that we talked about before, is going to cease being the deep kind of problem that we intuitively think that it is and should remain, right, so long as people are mistreating others in such heinous ways.
Is that because, let me ask you this, is if we say that humans are not self-determined, that they are determined by the physical world, right, then evils committed by humans are relevantly like any other kind of natural evil, like getting struck by lightning. It's just sort of the, what happens, you know, bad luck or something like that. It doesn't have the same sort of evilness about it that it would if it was committed by another agent. Is that...
Yeah, right. Just the way that some would say, look, getting hit by lightning isn't really evil, because evil carries with it these richer, more robust moral connotations, and this is just a naturalistic event.
Right.
If you think of human beings as just part of a of the naturalistic world, then all of our behaviors, too, are going to become explicable in those terms, right? And so, you know, it's not like the laws of physics and such are something we're exempt from and whatnot. No, everything that we do, too, despite our misleading phenomenological feelings of freedom, could not have been otherwise.
Right.
Right. So it's just the inevitable result of the world functioning according to the causal law. So given all the antecedent conditions in place, given the causal laws of the world, all of our behaviors are inevitable. It couldn't have been otherwise. And ultimately, we're not the source for those actions. In fact, all of our actions would be, and this is perhaps the most problematic aspect of all of our actions would be the inevitable, inexorable result of a causal chain that was initiated before we were ever born.
Right.
And so this really doesn't leave room for meaningful moral agency, except if you just sort of water that concept down. And by the way, have you noticed how this is such a recurring theme? Intrinsic human value that gets watered down, moral obligations that gets watered down. Now it's going to be free will that gets watered down by those who want to still retain these categories. This is almost inevitable, it seems to me. But if you come to terms with the implications and entailments of a mechanistic, determined world, it's awfully hard to make sense of moral responsibility. Thus, it's hard to make sense of that category of moral evil. This is one of the ways in which the problem of evil, more broadly construed, right, ceases to be a problem for our naturalistic friends. And they might say, well, this is good, right? The problem of evil, it's not our problem. But you see, our contention is, if it's not a problem for you because you lack the resources, you lack the vocabulary, you lack the categories, that now becomes the bigger problem for your worldview than the problem of evil is for the theist.
Well, you know, another thought I have on that too is, so I think that the problem of evil is even, quote unquote, less of a problem, and that's a problem for the naturalist because not only is the evil committed against you, sort of by other humans, just like being hit by lightning, it's just sort of what happens. But you're not even something, like, you're a part of the machinery too. So it's not as if something has happened to this intrinsically valuable person made in the image of God, you know, and that is where the evil is. It is that the feelings you have of being wronged are themselves illusory. For two reasons. Number one, because you're not the kind of thing that could be wronged. And number two, because the thing that wronged you doesn't really, you know, it's just doing what it does. It's a cog in the machine like everything else.
Yeah, right. I think this is right. And this leads to a kind of a paradox. The problem of evil, we want to say, is actually a far worse problem than the naturalists can even say that it is. Right? Yeah, we actually think the problem is far deeper than they even can begin to realize. The world really does contain things that are truly awful, truly bad, truly evil, including moral evils that should not have been done otherwise, that should not have happened, and think something else instead should have been done, something otherwise should have happened. We think that the problem of evil is a far worse problem, you see, than they can even make sense of. But we also think that the solution is available is a far richer, deeper solution than anything that they could muster on their worldview. I think that the problem of evil is a problem. I think it's something that needs to remain a problem. I think it's something that's far worse than often naturalists even begin to realize. But fortunately for us as Christians and theists, I think the resources for an ultimate resolution are far greater than anything that the naturalists could come up with.
Well, what exactly do you mean when you say that? How does that go? How does that account run of saying that Christians have a better way to get a grip on the problem of evil.
Yeah. Well, to begin with, again, we can make sense of the depth of the problem because we really are, in our worldview, people of intrinsic value, people of meaningful agency. We were made in God's image. The world really was supposed to be a particular way.
Right.
And so it's not that the world is just inevitably the way it is. The way it is, in certain respects, is not the way it ought to be, and we can make sense of that.
Right.
And here's the deal, though, right? We don't have to simply despair. We can hold out the hope, and it's not a wishful thinking kind of hope. It's a genuine, principled hope, grounded in reasons and evidence. We can have hope that there can be an ultimate resolution to the problem of evil. Why? Because there can be forgiveness for the wrongdoings. There can be reconciliation between alienated parties. There can be healing for the damage that was done, right? There can be reconciliation with God. There can be moral transformation as God works in us individually and together to restore to us, you know, what he intended. There can be redemption of the very creation and of the world and a return of the world to the way God originally intended it to be. God is the ultimate good, can constitute that incommensurable good for each one of us as we are in a relationship with him that can rectify, that can redeem, and even defeat all of the evils that we experience in this world, however horrific. There can be resources for the theist and for the Christian that go beyond the resources merely of this world. If this world were all that there is, right, then plenty of people would go to their deaths and there would be no hope for an ultimate reconciliation, an ultimate resolution, an ultimate redemption, an ultimate defeat of the evils. Their lives would simply be a testament to the tragedy of this life and the meaninglessness of so much of the suffering of this life. You know, so children, you know, burned to death in the Holocaust. I mean, that would be the end of their story and that would be it. And it's often in the names of those, suffering persons that proponents of the problem of evil will push, you know, see how bad the problem of evil is, you know. And if they're right, of course, and the world is tragic indeed in that sense, but, it's nothing to celebrate because it would really mean the abandonment of any sort of hope of an ultimate resolution. Theism and Christianity actually provide the resources for the hope of an ultimate resolution. So it's a problem ongoing. It's a problem whose solution we've seen the hint of, especially in the resurrection of Jesus and the defeat of death. But ultimately, we're going to see this problem completely fixed, completely healed. But only if theism is true and Christianity is true, it seems to me. So I think that the problem of evil, when you look at it, especially in isolation, you know, you think, wow, this really counts as powerful evidence against God's existence. And I can understand someone struggling with that. You know, I think that that's the natural sort of position to take when you consider it in isolation. But interestingly enough, when you really think about it carefully, right, and you really begin to unpack the parts and you begin to ask yourself, but what really gives this its urgency? What really gives this its purchase? What really gives this its traction? Language, categories, ontologies, and realities that make best sense only if theism is true and Christianity is true. If you take the problem of evil with dreadful seriousness, it seems to me, this is actually going to give you reasons to believe that a God must exist in order to redeem these sufferings. Otherwise, the sufferings are just as meaningless, just as pointless and purposeless as our biggest fears would have them be.
All right. Well, thank you for listening to the podcast. I hope you enjoyed the sneak preview of one of the chapters from the upcoming God and Cosmos by Dave Baggett and Jerry Walls. And I also want to just remind you that we have content going up on the website several times a week from a wide array of sources, including biblical scholars, literary scholars, philosophers. And you can also follow us on Twitter or like us on Facebook if you want to stay
and in the loop of what's happening at moralapologetics.com. Again, thanks for listening, and we'll catch you here at the same place next week.